I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams, and here is part four, the final instalment of Rugby League Reflections, a one-day conference to mark 21 years of Tom Brock activities. It's been a great week. We've got a lot of really thoughtful, positive feedback on the presentations we've put out this week. So really thankful to Crackernight Films for sharing the audio with us, and of course to the rest of the Tom Brock Bequest Committee for allowing us to put out these presentations through the Rugby League Digest feed. So this was the last session of the conference, and I think the most unified in theme. So we've had a very diverse range of presentations so far. These final three share a common thread in that they're all biographically based, covering three rugby league personalities from the early days of the code in Australia. And I dare say not many people outside of Andrew Ferguson would be particularly familiar with the three players that are going to be talked about. So kicking it off is John Brock, who is a member of the Tom Brock Committee as the Brock family representative, and he's giving a talk about another relative in his family, Albert Burtis. And I mentioned Andrew Ferguson. You'll hear John give a shout-out to the Rugby League Project during his talk, and it made me stop to think that there's never been a better time to get into rugby league history. You've got the amazing resource that is the Rugby League Project. You've got the Rugby League News on Trove, the rest of the digitized newspapers there as well. You've got databases such as Ancestry. There are so many places to go now to get historical information that if you do have an interest, it really is a great time to get involved. So I urge everyone to jump onto Trove, look at those Rugby League News issues if you haven't already. If you do want to get involved, but you don't know where to start, feel free to send us an email to therugbyleaguedigest@gmail.com. I do happen to have some professional expertise as well as obviously a personal interest. So I'd be happy to help with that, because John Brock's talk in particular, to me, really encapsulated the passion for rugby league history that at the very start of these presentations, you heard Andrew Moore talk about the innate passion for its history that rugby league fans share. And as I said, I think John's talk is really representative of that passion. So Albert Burtis is by no means a Hall of Famer or one of the greats of the game, but he has a story, and which John manages to bring out. It involves the Cumberland Rugby League Club, which don't get much of a Guernsey these days. I'll let John tell the story from here. This is Tragedy and Triumph, the story of Albert Burtis, a 1908 Foundation player.
Thanks very much, Kathy. I worked in Bundaberg for 2 years, so I know how parochial the Queenslanders are. We were coming home once, stopped at Gladstone for petrol. I said, "Where do you live?" I said, "To the south." They said, "What, come Coolangatta?" I know there's a bit further south than that, past the border. But anyway, I had a daughter born in Bundaberg Base Hospital about 18 months before Dr. Death went there, which was a very fortunate thing. But what I'm going to take, I'm going to take you back in time to the very early start of rugby league in New South Wales. And it will be a subset of one person taking you through the history of that particular decade between 1908 and 1917. And his name's Albert Burtis. He is the grandfather of my girlfriend, Karen McGay Topp. And he was born in a very illustrious name of the Vale of Clwyd, which just means the mining town of Lithgow. It's the Vale of Clwyd just on the other side of the Blue Mountains. And that was a Welsh name, of course, because the miners came from Wales and they called that place Vale of Clwyd. So what I've called this talk is Tragedy and Triumph. And you'll hear about the tragedy towards the end of the talk. The story of Albert Burtis, a 1908 Foundation rugby league player. Firstly, I'm going to say I have to pay tribute to my cousin Tom, the stalwart of South Sydney Rugby League Club and pioneer of rugby league history. If it wasn't for Tom, a lot of the history would have been lost that he collected. And he also nurtured other people how to do it as well. had to archive and things like that. And Andy's a typical example of showing how Tom's leadership and inspiration put them into that area. Now, 1908, this is a very big year. One of my favourite men in history, Donald Bredman, was born, 1908. And you'll find out why he's one of my favourites later on. In that same year, Jack Johnson, the African-American, made short work of Tommy Burns at the Sydney Stadium. In the first boxing match where mixed coloured people were allowed to fight each other, the stadium was built that year, the same year, 1908. And Lord Nolan won the Melbourne Cup. In that year, or the year before, 1907, in Bateman's Hotel in George Street, which is still there, in 1907, it's where they first concocted the theory about doing the rugby league. And why did they do that? Because the rugby union people treated their players poorly when they got injured. It was all about compensation for the injured players. So the rugby league players said, we'll leave. And my player comes from the Western Suburbs rugby union team, and they formed a club called Cumberland. I'll show you some of the... These are the foundation clubs. And you might notice that Annandale and Glebe... Oh, Glebe is there, sorry. Annandale is not there. Now, that formed, I think, the next year or the year after, I'm not too sure. But these are the clubs that are actually formed. And it's ironic, you see Newcastle up there, and you also see Cumberland with the blue and gold. Same as Parramatta, in the similar area. Not quite the same. I'll show you the geographic area in a minute. But Annandale's where I was born. I was born in the Queen Victoria Hospital in Johnston Road. It was a boutique birthing hospital, and now it's a nursing home. So I said, I started off there, I'll probably end up there. Here's what Birchgrove Oval looked like. Now, this is the main stadium that they used, Birchgrove Oval. They also used Pratt and Park. They used Sydney Agricultural Stadium, and there's another couple of grounds as well. I just have to... Wentworthville? Okay, mate. Well, here's what Birchgrove Oval looks like today. It's still being used, of course, out near Balmain, where the uppies live. This is the first game of rugby league at Birchgrove Oval, North versus South. Monday the 20th of April, 1908, at 2 p.m, South 11-7. The significance of this date is that Cumberland, Central Cumberland was their full name, they did not participate in the first round of the competition, because on that day, in this hotel here, the Horse and Jockey Hotel along Parramatta Road, is the day they were founded. The Cumberland Club, there's a plaque there. Cumberland Rugby League Club was established at this location on the evening of the 20th of April, 1908. So they didn't participate in the first round, but they did start in the second round. That shows you the historical significance of this place. This is the colours they had. Very similar, aren't they, to another team you might remember these days. They haven't got the same jersey now, but they did have when they first started. Parramatta had a jersey like this. Central Cumberland, 1908 Rugby League Club, a.k.a. Cumberland. This is the geographical zone. Around Homebush and surrounding environs, you can see Western Suburbs further out, actually where Parramatta is now, more like it. But that's the layout that they had the particular clubs living on. You virtually had to live in that locality to play for the side is what, I don't know whether they complied with it too often, but that was the theory behind it. I'll take you back to Parramatta in 1900. There was no motorised transport, but there is a rail line there. That's for a tram. So the horse and carts had to get out of the way when the tram came barreling through. I don't know how often. Probably not too often. It's probably as reliable as the trains we have these days. Or the light rail that's never going to come. The light rail's a disgrace in Parramatta. They're going to knock down the Royal Oak Hotel. And that's where Parramatta Rugby League side used to drink all the time. It's an outrage. Here we go. Central Cumberland, 1908 side. Now, I asked Karen McGay, is granddad in this photograph? She couldn't make out because it's a bit blurry. This is out of a fantastic book called The History of Rugby League Clubs by Ian Collis and Glad Whittaker. Brilliant book. It's about that thick. I bought it on the net for $25. Magnificent. Fantastic book. Great detail. I'll also let you know about a brilliant site called the Rugby League Project on the internet. There's a bunch of guys putting together all these details about rugby league players. Now, I didn't think I'd ever find anything about Albert's playing career because I was having a bit of trouble in the Encyclopedia Rugby League. Didn't even have him playing for Cumberland. Well, these guys, they've got every game he played, what number he played, if he scored a try, what the halftime score was, what the crowd was, where it's played at, what the referee's name was. What a site. Absolutely phenomenal. Get on the internet and have a look at it if you've got anyone you're interested in looking about to discover information about. Now, talking about those programs that Andy was showing, another fantastic site. Western Suburbs have got a brilliant archive. Someone told me it's in a little house across the road from the Leagues Club. I think it's in Asheville, I'm not too sure. But they sent to Kerry McGay these programs. Now, this 1908 program was not because Albert was playing for Western Suburbs. As I said, he played for Cumberland. But the ironic thing about it is, Albert is showing here... Sorry, that's not the right one, is it? Yeah, Albert, Western Suburbs, Cumberland. He's playing for Cumberland against Western Suburbs. So it's only because West are in that game that they got Albert there, but ironically playing for Cumberland. But in the rugby league project, it doesn't have him playing that day. So as Andy says, sometimes the program might not reflect the actual team on the day because it's done in advance. This is possibly what happened here. Nevertheless, there's his name in an original program from 1908. Incredible information. The only game that Cumberland won was that game I showed you the program for. They beat West in that game. In 1908, against rivals West, July 4th, 1908, the crowd of 3,000 people. There's the page that comes out of the Rugby League Project. Tells you the score, the referee, everything that you want to know. All the players, their numbers. As I say, this is probably right. The program may not be. So you have to take those into account. Here's a bit more stuff about Albert. 1908, they say he played four games for Cumberland. And there they are. The grounds they played at. Oh, no, they haven't got the ground they played at. But if you click on another thing there, it tells you later on. You can find out that information. Tells you the score, etc. What position he played, fantastic stuff. Karen McGay wasn't really interested in me researching this because she reckons her granddad was a cranky old fella. But he's a very interesting man and his life reflects much of things that happened to other people during that period. This is the Cumberland stats. They're not real flash, they only won one game. They're the worst record of rugby league club in the history of rugby league, Cumberland. And the fact that there is any information about them at all is a miracle because they only lasted 1 year and I can't believe how they had information stored about these people. Amazing information. So he went on, him and one of the books has been written by someone who will remain unmentionable. It says only three players from Cumberland went on to play first grade again. Unfortunately, he's wrong on five accounts because there's five other players, Albert one of them, who went on to play for Western Suburbs. 1909, one game. 1912, one game. 1913, we have a program here. This is another one showing Albert's name. Wes playing Newtown in this game. In 1913 was Albert's best year of football. That's the amount of games he played. 13 or 14 games, 1913 for Wes. Now, he stops at the end of 1913 and doesn't play again till 1917. And the first thing that came to my mind was the First World War. Wouldn't it, you think? 4 years missing, and all of a sudden he comes back. And he's 32 to play first grade again. Well, I'll tell you what happened to him. Well, this is the only game he scored a try in first. 27-19, Albert scores a try. Saturday the 24th of May, North Sydney Oval. That's North Sydney Oval now, in current times. Here's a picture of Albert in the 1913 West Side. That's Grandad there. And he also, I don't know anyone knows about this club here, Parramatta Endeavour Football Club, but apparently they're a feeder club for one of the other, for West maybe or something, I don't know, but Albert's in this one here. There he is in the middle. So there you go. But they say they won the premiership in those years, so I don't know how they did concurrently when he was playing for West, playing for this side as well. I'm not sure how that happened. But as I said, that's his entire career. You get in one page. If you're looking for a player, I'll give you the things. And between 1913 and 1917, as I said, he didn't play at first grade. I just want to show you his brother, Stanley George Burtis. He won the Distinguished Service Order in the First World War in France. That's Stanley there. Now, he got nominated by his compatriots for a VC. His troop was getting mowed down by a machine gun fire. Stanley charged in and single-handedly disarmed two machine gun nests on his own. But these obnoxious old Englishmen decided to downgrade the VC nomination to a DSO. Because he's not English? What is that? Anyway, I think if it went retrospectively, they'd give him a VC for that. That's a very courageous act. He's also found on the Royal World War I Memorial Gate in Parramatta. That's it in 1918. And there's Stanley's name. there. Now, Albert didn't go to the war because he was working in essential service. He was working for the railways. And this is what happened to him. The newspaper headline of the tragic burning accident in Parramatta, which cost Albert's first young wife, Clara, her life on the 1st of February 1914. He came home about 12:15 not at night on the 1st of Feb. She went to make him a cup of tea. They had methylated spirits making things like those, and lights and all that. Her nightgown caught on fire. She was that badly burnt, she was dead by midday that same day in Parramatta Hospital. Tragic incident. This is why he doesn't play for another 4 years. This is what I'm thinking, because he had three young children to look after. Would have been a big job, especially a man as cranky as what Kerry McGarrick as he was. This is where the property was. This is St. John's Cemetery in Parramatta, if you know where it is. Pitt Street, at number 16, Pitt Street. That's where it was. And this is where Albert's last resting place is, at Maze Hill Cemetery. Albert Burtis, 2nd of June 1961. And Kerry McGarrick's story is, they don't like the colour green, and she told a pop, don't wear green. And he wore a green shirt out that day and had a heart attack at the bus stop. That's what she said. Bit suspicious, a bit, you know. And does this ring a bell to you? There's a Parramatta jersey, formed in 1947, very similar to the jersey of Cumberland. And I would say the Parramatta people looked at that and said, in a traditional sense, we'll use the blue and gold for our side in 1947 that came into the comp. Before I go, I'm going to show you something about Sir Donald Bradman. Now, Ted Zolkovich, my mate, my best mate's in the audience there, just there with the orange shirt. He and I went to see Sir Donald Bradman. 26th of March 1999, we're sitting in the lounge room in Donald's, Sir Don's room. Oh, I'll show my daughter standing at the front of his house. And Ted asked the question. We didn't even talk cricket to Sir Donald Bradman. Can you believe that? We talk rugby league most of the time. And Ted asked Sir Donald the question, who's your favourite rugby league side, Sir Donald? To which Sir Donald said, the Rabbitohs, South Sydney. Sir Donald Bradman's favourite rugby league side was South Sydney. Can you believe that? And he used to say, oh yeah, Johnny, I would wait till half time because you get him for free. Watch him at the SCG. That's what Don said. Oh, he's a funny guy. And what I'd just like to say now is a very special thank you to Kath Haynes for putting together such a great and fitting tribute to celebrate the brilliant work of the Tom Brock Bequest Committee over the last 21 years. A superb effort by all committee members. Thank you for attending.
Okay, so next we have a presentation by Terry Williams. Terry, if you don't know, is in the uppermost tier in terms of rugby league history in Australia. There are few people more knowledgeable than Terry. He's written multiple books on rugby league history. He was formerly the boss of the museum over at Rugby League Central, a passionate Newtown man, and brings all of this experience and knowledge into his presentation, titled Almost a Kangaroo, which is the story of a player named Robert Nicholson. And in this talk, you'll hear some of the eternal themes about rugby league in Australia. You've got New South Wales v Queensland, bungling officials, player misbehaviour. It's all there. In a story that would go untold, but for people like Terry, but for events such as this conference. And this is where the Tom Brock Committee stands alone in Australia. I don't think you're getting this kind of content anywhere else. So it's why I'm very proud to be a part of this organisation. And why, again, I'll re-emphasise the point, it's a very exciting time for rugby league history in this country. So I'm going to let Terry take it from here. This is Almost a Kangaroo, Robert Nicholson.
Being near the end of the queue after such a great lineup of previous speakers reminds me of what Clive Lloyd said when he had to speak last at a celebrity cricket dinner. I feel like Elizabeth Taylor's sixth husband. I know what to do, but the challenge is to make it interesting. On that note, we'll get started. Rugby league's history is full of strange and interesting stories, but few can match that of Bob Nicholson. Ratbaggery, or players having personal issues, is nothing new, as his story and history tells us. Born in the Manning River District at Taree in 1880, he was the second of six children to Robert James Nicholson and his wife Harriet Nee Williams, no relation. No relation to me. Young Robert grew up in the Manning District, had a minimal education and worked as a labourer. but his life changed when he married in 1897. Given that both he and his bride, Alice May Wootton, were only 17, one suspects that she may have been pregnant. Their first son, Stanley, was born in 1898, less than 9 months later. Three more boys would follow: Walter, born in 1900, Cecil, born 1909, and Clarence, 1911. By the time Cecil was born, they were living in Newcastle, whilst Clarence was born in Sydney, but more of that later. Nicholson played rugby union with North Newcastle in 1907 alongside George Hardy, and then was one of those who threw in their lot with the fledgling code in 1908, playing with Newcastle in their first season in the New South Wales Rugby League Premiership. His peers there, which is this team shot, included such as William Jerry Bailey, who's bottom left, Stan Carpenter, who's got the ball, who went on to get a recommended for the Victoria Cross himself, but was awarded the DFC. And Pat Nimmo Walsh, he was actually nominated twice for the VC, once at Gallipoli on the landing and also at Posse Airs. Where am I here? Oh, and Pat Nimmo Walsh, who was they were all internationals, as well as his old mate, Puddin' Hardy, who would go on to be killed in action during the First World War. So all those guys were in that Newcastle team in 1908 wearing their red and white striped jerseys. By 1908, at the age of near 28, Nicholson's decision to switch was more about principle than money, since they were basically amateurs, but covered by insurance and payments if they missed work for matches or through injury. Nicholson must have done well enough in that pioneer season to interest some onlookers, and he moved to Brisbane for their first domestic season in 1909. The infant body in Queensland had been able to muster an adequate number of players, sympathetic players, to assemble an interstate team in 1908 when the game commenced, and they had built enough of a foundation to commence a four-team club competition up there in 1909. Nicholson joined South Brisbane and actually started as a halfback, more a reflection on his skills than his size. Most of the players of that era were smaller and lighter than the modern behemoths, and although Nicholson was regarded as a big forward, he only stood at 5'8", or 173 centimetres for the digitally inclined. Our man made an impression from the very start and played for possibles against probables before making his Queensland debut. The truth said, Nicholson, a big lusty chap with plenty of dash, played splendidly, though he would show to more advantage if he was in the forwards. That was their report on May 16, 1909. Robert Nicholson then won selection for Australia's second test against the Kiwis on June 26, 1909, as Australia defeated New Zealand 10-5 in Brisbane, their first victory over their trans-Tasman rivals in Brisbane, in the northern capital. He and his South Brisbane clubmates Herb Brackenridge and Vic Anderson were regarded as having been as good as any forwards from either New South Wales or New Zealand, but only Brackenridge was retained for the decider. Often they would include more Queenslanders for a local test match simply to build up the gate, basically. Nicholson scored in Queensland's 21-11 win over the visiting Maori team in early August, and then showed it was no fluke a week later when he posted Australia's first try in a stirring 16-13 victory in the test against the Maori. In reviewing the season, the Brisbane Truth offered, Nicholson is the grandest forward who has played the game. A big, heavy chap, he's a beautiful tackler and a very fast runner. When in possession of the sphere, he can run like a three-quarter and can mix it with the best of them. I should have pointed out, sorry, that's him with the stylish moustache in the back row next to the referee. His good form continued in 1910, and he appeared for Australia in the second test against James Lomas's Englishmen, a narrow 22-17 loss, and featured in all of Queensland's big games against New South Wales and the visiting British team. Quality's not real good on the photo. For some reason, there are very few decent photos of representative teams from Queensland before 1920. He's in the back row on their left, next to Herb Brackenridge. Before the start of the 1911 season, though, Nicholson's fortune took a turn for the worst. Although he played his football under his right name, he had been using an alias of Alfred Nichols in Brisbane socially and had married under that name in July 1909. He was accordingly charged and found guilty of bigamy in February 1911, as reported in the Cairns Post of March 15. At the criminal sittings of the District Court today, Robert Harding Nicholson, the well-known footballer, in case you didn't know him, who had pleaded guilty to a charge of bigamy, was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment, which would be suspended on entering his own recognizances to be of good behaviour. The trial was an embarrassment to him and was salaciously reported in the press, as you'd imagine. His initial defence that he thought Alice was dead failed to convince the judge. especially when she'd borne him another child whilst he had been in Brisbane. He kept playing football, however, and was still chosen for Queensland matches against New South Wales and New Zealand ahead of the Australasian Kangaroo Tour of 1911-12. That's Brackenridge with the writing on his pants. Nicholson's on his left there. Doesn't look particularly happy, but this is 1911 when he's back in Sydney. Next one. In June, the Maroons played three matches in Sydney against a strong New South Wales side over an eight-day period and copped a footballing lesson, with New South Wales winning all three matches, 65-9, 49-0 and the last 32-8, during which Nicholson had to leave the field with an injury. It was a telling insight into the relative football strengths of the two competing states at the time. 2 days after the last contest, while still in Sydney, Nicholson was charged with desertion of children. He appeared in court the next day and was sentenced to 6 months imprisonment or sureties for 6 months, which basically guaranteed him providing for his children. Within a day, he had found the funds necessary and was released. A fortnight later, he was back on the field in representative teams, appearing for the first 13 against the second 13 in a Queensland trial that also served as a fundraiser for the family of one of the QRL founders, Mickey Dore. The Queenslanders now faced the touring New Zealanders in a three-match series in Queensland before the Kiwis returned to Sydney for their last match against New South Wales ahead of selection for the Australasian touring team for the Tour of Great Britain. Honours were shared in the first two clashes, but New Zealand won the decider against the Maroons 18-14. You can see that the scores were a lot closer, though, so the relative football strengths, it was obviously a better game of footy to watch. When the touring squad was initially selected, Bob Nicholson was in the team as the only representative from Queensland. But within a week, his selection was not endorsed by the New South Wales Rugby Football League Management Committee, your old friends, Kath. This was 13 years before the formation of the Australian Rugby League, and the New South Wales Rugby League Management Committee was the peak administrative body in the game here at the time. They controlled the selection process and the finances from the representative matches. Although the game in Sydney was making plenty of money, it was a different story in those frontier districts, which meant that the Queenslanders and New Zealand officials were probably more deferential to the New South Wales boys than they might otherwise have been. There was no mention of his off-field misdemeanours, and it was regarded as being purely based on form, according to the Arrow. The Rugby League's action in declining to endorse the selection of R.H. Nicholson, the Queensland forward in the team for England, is practically a vote of censure on the selectors. The inclusion of Nicholson in the team was a great surprise to most people. The only two Queenslanders on Sydney form one was prepared to see among the chosen are Dee McGregor, the fullback, and C. Woodhead, the three quarterback, and both men less on present form than their possibilities with regular match play among first-class exponents of the game. The media north of the border had a different take on it, though, as articulated in the Queensland Times. Great dissatisfaction is felt in local rugby league circles at the treatment meted out to the Queensland League in connection with the selection of a team for England by the omission of Nicholson. If the latter is not to be included in the team, it is felt that McGregor, who was the fullback, should represent Queensland. The local league was given to understand that McGregor was a certainty, and the action of the southern body is likely to cause a split in the league ranks. Many prominent players are already talking of severing their connections with the league. But the league authorities were obviously aware of the situation, as the trail of correspondence reported in the Sydney Morning Herald indicates. A telegram from the New South Wales Rugby Football League has been received by R. Nicholson, whose name was included in the list of those selected as members of the Australasian team to tour Great Britain, stating that his inclusion in the team has not been endorsed by the committee, and adding that a letter was to follow. Nicholson had already received a letter of invitation setting forth the conditions and asking him if he would go. The Queensland League is dissatisfied with the failure to include McGregor, whose display of fullback against New Zealand was the subject of favourable comment. The local league expected to have at least three representatives. By the way, the caps that their representative team wore away on their second Kangaroo Tour featured the blue of New South Wales, the black of the Kiwis, and the red of the Queenslanders, but obviously no Queenslanders. One can only imagine the personal torment Nicholson went through, albeit of his own creation. It was a very public excoriation of a player and denied him the trip of a lifetime and perhaps a chance at reputational redemption. The mental and emotional scars, one suspects, have remained with him ever after. Dally Messenger and Sandy Pearce, who had both been selected in the initial team with Nicholson, also declined to tour at the time, and the three vacancies were filled by Chuck Fraser, Bob Stewart and Steve Darmody from South Sydney. For all the fuss and furore, it should be pointed out that Chris McKippett's second Kangaroos, the Australasian team of 1911-12, won the Ashes, a feat that would not be repeated until 1963. So obviously they got a few things right. Nicholson played with Kurupa in the Brisbane competition in 1912 and again won selection for Queensland and subsequently returned to New South Wales and reconciled as best he could with Alice. He played with North Sydney in 1914. He's the last player in the right-hand side in the back row next to the gentleman in the vest. Interestingly, down in the front right row is George Duffin, who also played in that Queensland team in 1911 and was also a prominent cricketer. He played with North Sydney in 1914 and made five first-grade appearances, but at 34, his best footballing days were over. The following season, he played briefly at Wyong and then served a short stint as a referee, which seems to have been his final involvement with the game. Census records show that he and Alice were living together at Wyong in 1930 and Redfern in 1936, but it appears that they had ongoing troubles in their relationship, as might be expected. Census records indicate they were apart at times, whether through expedience, monetary concerns or choice is not known. He worked as an auctioneer and fish agent at times on the Central Coast and also assisted when she was running a boarding house at Redfern at one stage in the 1930s. Robert Harding Nicholson died on March 31, 1940, when he collapsed while sitting on a garden bench at the Newcastle home he shared with his mother. Even in death, the truth about his career was distorted, as this report from the Newcastle Morning Herald and Miners Advocate on Monday, April 8, 1940, reveals. R.H. Nicholson, formerly a prominent Queensland rugby league forward, has died at his mother's home at Skelton Street, Hamilton. At one time, he was employed by the tramway department in Newcastle. He had played for Australia against New Zealand and England and was a life member of the Newcastle League. Nicholson was at the top of his form in 1911 when he was selected to go to England with the Kangaroos. He went aboard the ship, but at the last minute decided not to go. Rewriting history. Nicholson, who was 60, was buried at Jillaby near Wyong. When Alice died in 1950, she was buried alongside him. Whether that was out of love or financial necessity is not clear. This forensic overview leaves many unanswered questions. What sort of man was Robert really like? How much did the selectors know? And then the general committee when they didn't ratify his selection? What became of him after his playing days ended? And what of his relationship with Alice? How did she cope with the whole thing? Was theirs a love story or one of endurance? Without any personal or family insight, it's impossible to know, but it is a very modern and fascinating yarn. The voracious 21st century media would love it. Nicholson wasn't the first or last player to experience domestic difficulties, and they remain part of the game in 2019. Just ask Sam Burgess. One suspects that will be the case in rugby league forevermore because, as in so many other areas, it reflects wider society and the humanity of those who play it. It's another part of being what esteemed British historian Geoffrey Moorhouse called the people's game. Thank you.
Okay, and finally today we have Tom Mather giving his talk, The Other Dave Brown. Again, Tom is talking about a player right at the beginning of rugby league in Australia. So like the other two players we've just heard, not a household name, but someone with a very rich story. And who better to tell it than Tom Mather, who's written many books on rugby league history. He's from the north of England, now living in Western Australia, a very entertaining speaker who manages to flesh out this really rich, compelling story that shares a lot of parallels with the Robert Nicholson story, actually. So I found this talk a great way to round out the day at Ryde Eastwood Leagues Club. A highly entertaining and informative presentation, so let's go straight to it. This is Tom Mather with The Other Dave Brown.
Good afternoon, everybody. I've got Terry Williams here today because I didn't have time to put subtitles on the screen. So if you don't understand what I'm saying, if you ask Terry afterwards, he knows quite well.
Yeah, 3:30.
I'd like to talk to you this afternoon about the other Dave Brown. Now, when you mention the name of Dave Brown, you tend to think of the Eastern Suburbs player of the 1930s. This guy had a stellar career, captained his club, captained the tourists over in England. He actually captained Warrington when he had a spell in the UK, that actually beat the tourists when they were on tour. He was often referred to as the Bradman of rugby league, inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2003. A great, great player. Sadly, he's not the player I want to talk to you about today. There is another Dave Brown, who also played for the Eastern Suburbs Club in the 1980s. This Dave Brown, a prop forward, signed for the club from Brisbane South in the 1980s. He was a tough, no-nonsense prop forward. Played 5 tests for Australia. He had 2 spells with the Eastern Suburbs. In between, he had a spell at Manly, but we won all that against him. And he then went over to Hull to play. When he came back to Australia, he travelled over to Perth in Western Australia to play for the Belmore Steelers as a player coach. Great player. Unfortunately, he's not the Dave Brown that I want to talk to you about today.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There was another Dave Brown who also played for the Eastern Suburbs. He was born in the Eastern Suburbs in 1886. And there he is. Now, this Dave Brown is now long forgotten. He would not become an international until 2004. And in that year, the Australian Board of Control decided to award caps to those players who had opposed the Maori back in 1909. It is remarkable, not to say confusing, for researchers such as myself to have 3 players, all with the same name, all playing for Eastern Suburbs, and all Australian internationals. It makes life very difficult when you want to research. This Dave Brown, the subject of this player, was a remarkable individual in his own right who had a somewhat troubled life. But I'm getting ahead of myself a bit here. Brown was born on the 13th of May in 1886, and he lived and grew up in the Eastern Suburbs. There, he gravitated, we are told, towards the Eastern Suburbs of the Union Club, and he would make his debut in 1906. I researched the 1906 season thoroughly. I couldn't find him playing for Eastern Suburbs that year. But in that year, there were some great players playing for Eastern Suburbs. Messenger, Devereux, Breckenridge, the D.L. Fugette brothers, Stunts and Rosenfeld. This Dave Brown was actually a 5'8", but he was equally at home playing in the centre or playing on the wing. When it became public knowledge in 1907 that the professional game was going to come to Sydney via Albert Baskerville's All Goals, he, like a lot of others, took up Giltinan's offer to play this new Northern Union code. Brown actually played in the second of those 3 test matches that were played that year. He played at 5'8". 3 days later, on the 24th of August, he played again against the New Zealanders. This time he played in the centre. And as we all know now, there was so little known about the rules of this new code of Northern Union, all of the games were played under rugby union rules. In 1908, in January, Brown, along with many others, attended a meeting at Paddington Town Hall, which saw the birth of the Eastern Suburbs Northern Union Club. And the preparations and training began to play in those first games of Giltinan's Rugby League. They were played on Easter Monday in 1908. And that afternoon, Brown played in the centre and his partner was John Stunts on the wing. They played Newcastle, Newtown, And the game is well remembered and long remembered because John Stumps actually scored 4 tries that afternoon and could have had more. It's a feat that's never been achieved since by a player debuting in the NRL.
Sorry, Maggie Maloney.
Is she the one who had the cockle stall in Dublin?
Sorry?
Is she the one who had the cockle stall in Dublin? Brown gets a mention in the match report because he scored a try early in the second half. And he gets a second mention because he came to the assistance of John Stunts late in the game when Stunts got into a blue with a Newtown player, which caused 3 or 4 Newtown supporters to jump the fence and run to attack John O' Stunts. And Brown actually came to his assistance and got him out of trouble that afternoon. During that first season, Brown would play 11 games for the club. The club did quite well. They got to the finals. They beat North Sydney in the semis. And in the final, they met South Sydney. Again, Brown played in the centre that afternoon. His wing partner was Horry Miller, who would go on to become the league secretary following the death of Edward Larkin in the First World War. Unfortunately, he was on the wrong end of a 14-12 scoreline that afternoon. At this point, it might well be advantageous to examine just what was happening to Brown and his life off the field. He was living in the eastern suburbs, and the eastern suburbs back then was not the eastern suburbs of today. It was noted for its sly grog shops, prostitution was rife, and there were a number of gangs roaming the streets. Brown came from a very staunch Roman Catholic family. And at the age of just 20, he was living with a woman by the name of Olive Deloitte, which would have been quite scandalous at the time because they weren't married. Adding to the scandal is the allegation that he had 2 children with Olive. Ina came in 1907. Lawrence came in 1908. I say it's alleged for reasons which will become a bit clearer. There is a great deal of evidence, albeit circumstantial, that Olive was earning a living as a prostitute. And you can imagine that would cast some doubt as to whether or not he was the father of the 2 children. He was also hanging around with, shall we say, some unsavoury characters in the eastern suburbs district. And as we shall see later, his mother referred to him as being a troubled boy. I'd like you to hold on to that because it becomes relevant a little later. On the field, he was playing with some great players, so he couldn't really fail to impress. And when the second season came around, he was still playing first grade. He did miss the first game of the season because on that occasion, he was actually marrying Olive. Now, you'd like to think that he was marrying Olive out of love and the fact that he wanted to make an honest woman of her. In actual fact, he married her because she was carrying her 3rd child. And we know that Olive seems to have carried on with her career because once she married Dave Brown, she seemed to be operating under any one of 3 surnames. She would use the name Brown, the name Deloitte, or the name Crocker. So it just gives a little bit more credence to the just how she was earning a living. During that 1909 season, the Maori toured Queensland and New South Wales, and when the 3rd test came around, Brown was actually selected to play. And he played in the centre, and his partner that day on the wing was John Stunts. Australia won the game 23-16 and Brown actually crossed for the 1st try. But as that season progressed, it seems he had other irons in the fire, did our Mr. Brown. With Olive pregnant and her 3rd child, he actually wrote to both Warrington and Barrow over in England asking for trials. That was the norm back then. And we know that Warrington actually wanted to sign Dally Messenger following Gilton and ill-fated tour. And at the very last moment, Messenger pulled out of the deal. So the Warrington directors contacted people in Sydney and asked them to name a suitable replacement. And almost to a man, they named John Stunts. Now, I believe that John Stunts and Dave Brown were very good friends, and reports tell us that Stunts contacted Warrington and also contacted Barrow and hatched a plan for the two of them to travel over to England together, which they did. The Barrow Club arranged for Brown to travel over to play trials, and the two of them set sail for England in September 1909. When the news broke in Barrow that Brown was coming, the place was abuzz with excitement. Brown was the club's first ever overseas signing, and an international at that, according to him. There is no doubt whatsoever that Brown exaggerated his abilities on the playing field. It was true he had played for Australia, but back then it was not considered to be an international match. He'd also played for New South Wales on a number of occasions. The referee in September informs us of just what he was doing. Dave Brown received offers from Warrington and Barrow and will make the trip with his teammate, John Stunts, to play for Barrow. When you think about it, Brown was on a hiding to nothing, really, when you examine the facts. He was playing in a very good sides with Eastern Suburbs, Australia, New South Wales. He was travelling to play for a team that was struggling in that competition, which was the Northern Union. Also, he had only 2 years' experience of playing this new Northern Union game, and he would be playing week in and week out against players who had far more experience of the game than he had. The game was 14 years old in England. It was 2 years old in Sydney. And also, the game that was played down in Sydney was totally different to the game that was played over in England at that time. When he arrived in Barrow, he arrived to a fanfare of publicity, and the club found him employment in the shipyard in the town, the Vickers Shipyard. And a game was arranged within the shipyard between the engine side of the yard and the ship side of the yard. And Brown actually played for the ship side, for the engine side, I'm sorry. And of course everybody wanted to have a pop at this colonial, didn't they? But he did show that he'd got good speed, had a good body swerve, and more importantly, he was a strong tackler. Following that game, the directors of the Barrow Club decided they'd seen enough. They actually selected him to play in first grade against Runcorn on the 27th of November 1909. It has to be said that the local reporter for the Barrow Herald was less than impressed with what he saw of Brown that afternoon. What on earth is the use of bringing David Brown over from Australia? All he did was stand still and catch cold. I'm anxious to see him on attack. Never had the ball in hand to gauge him. He played centre, but would be better at half-back. I cannot recall him receiving one pass. The club must have been impressive enough because they actually signed him to a contract. And he signed the contract to play for the Barrow Club. When he settled down to play on a regular basis for the club, sadly, it all went downhill. Reporters began to investigate the claims that he had made. They could find no proof supporting the claims that he'd made. And people in the media began to think that he was a charlatan who had pulled the wool over everyone's eyes. Certainly, he was not making the impression on the field that was expected of an international player. There is a report in the Athletic News on the 7th of February 1910, which is quite revealing. The Barrow team have given some tame exhibitions at Cavendish Park this season, but for sheer ineptitude, their performance against Lee will stand out by itself. He was quite complimentary about Brown. Brown was resolute in defence, but that was the best it got. Back. Wrong one. Let's have a look. There's an article. This, in that same article, the reporter quite cuttingly said, Dobson stood out by himself as the only back on the Barrow side showing any intelligent conception of what was required of a player. Doesn't say a great deal about our friend Dave Brown. Equally worrying was the company that he was keeping in Barrow. It seems that the company he was keeping there matched the company he'd been keeping in the eastern suburbs. Unfortunately, we can't see what was written about him or read between the lines and infer what was happening because the copies of the Barrow Herald were stored in a basement in the city. And many years ago, they were flooded, destroying all the records and all the newspapers. But it became quite obvious that he was adding nothing to a team that was struggling in the competition. The clamour also was growing in Barrow that he duped the club and its supporters with regard to his playing abilities. And so as the season came to an end, he was allowed to return home. Not surprised there then. He arrived back in Sydney in the middle of June. And on returning home, he went to see his loving wife, Olive, and his three growing children, went into the house and found that his wife, Olive, was carrying her fourth child. But seeing that the child had been conceived in March when he was in Barrow, I don't think it was his child, unless it was an immaculate conception, he seems to have accepted the situation, got on with living his life, as if nothing had happened, which would add even more weight to just how Olive was supporting the growing family while he'd been away. He returned to the Eastern Suburbs Club and he would play one more game. He played that game, ironically, against Newtown in a 4-4 draw. And his half-back partner that day, he played 5-8, his half-back partner was Barney Dalton. Now, nothing untoward about that until you realise that Dalton was to become a well-known member of the Kate Lee Razor Gang. And he was shot and killed on the 9th of November 1929, coming out of the hotel in Sydney. Whilst back in Sydney, Burns seems to have gone back to mixing with the same people he'd mixed with before he left. He got employment as a railway porter working at Home Bus Station. He went to work on Christmas Eve 1910 and went about his normal duties, were led to believe. At around 5:30 p.m. he was found lying by the side of the track suffering from multiple injuries. The Daily Telegraph reported the event. David Brown, a prominent footballer, was fatally injured on Saturday night while about to light some lamps at the signals just after 5:30 p.m. He was found against one of the home signals, bleeding from wounds all over his body. It is believed he'd been knocked down by a train. He was taken to the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital by civil ambulance, suffering from compound fracture of the left thigh, compound fracture of the left arm, and severe lacerations about his head and body. The assumption was that he'd been struck by a train, but surely, in broad daylight, the train driver or a fireman would have seen it. Equally mysterious is, why was he not missed by his workmates? We have no idea what time he went to light these supposed lights on Christmas Eve in the middle of summer. Why would you go out to the track and light lamps? More contentious, I suppose, is the company that he was keeping. And I'd ask you to go back to the phrase that was on the screen earlier that his mother said of him about him being a troubled boy. What did she mean by that? I am assuming she meant the company he was keeping, the life he was living. So when you take those things into contention, the question must be asked, did he fall? Did he jump? Or was he pushed? The latter cannot be discounted, because way back in 1910, Homebush Station was quite isolated, so any illegal activity on the trackside would not have been seen. The inquest into his death was held on the 13th of January. And there's the official inquest report on a man's life, 7 lines. It read, I find that the said David Joseph Brown at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital on the 24th day of December died from the effects of injuries accidentally received on the same day through being run over by a train at Homebush Station. Now, I know times were different in 1910, but surely an accident on the railway demanded a little more investigation than this poor chap got from the official coroner. It seems nobody was questioned. None of the workmen were questioned. None of the people who found him were questioned. None of the doctors and medical staff who treated him were questioned. It seems as if it was an open and shut case. And that being the case, the sooner you close it, the better. Dave Brown was buried on the 27th of December at Waverley Cemetery, and just a week after his death, his wife Olive, or his widow Olive, gave birth to her fourth child. So clearly, Dave Brown was not the father. Throughout his short life, he was just 24 when he died, Dave Brown. He played just 21 games for Eastern Suburbs. He played 11 games for Barrow. He played 9 games for New South Wales and 1 for Australia. He was, during his lifetime, never afforded the privilege of being a test player. That changed in 2004, as I said, when the Australian Board of Control took the decision to award caps to those players who'd played in those 3 games against the Maori way back in 1909. In doing so, they created a remarkable situation, namely that 3 players, all from the Eastern Suburb Club, all named Dave Brown, were now Australian test players. They also made the job of researchers like myself considerably more difficult. I set out to inform you in this paper of the other Dave Brown, and I hope that I've given you just a glimpse, albeit a quick one, into the life of this troubled boy who played this great game of ours. Thank you.
Good job, very, very well done.
Okay, so that's it for this episode, and that's it for Rugby League Reflections. So big thanks again to Crackernight Films for sharing the audio, Kath Haynes for organising a fantastic conference, the rest of the Tom Brock Committee for all the hard work that was done to get this ready, and of course the 12 speakers who I think collectively have produced a really important body of work that I'm very proud as the host of the Rugby League Digest to be able to present it on our podcast feed. So we would love to hear what you thought about any of these presentations or anything else. The Rugby League Digest at gmail.com. Hit us up on Facebook and Twitter. Give Tom Brock a follow on both of those platforms. And we will be back very soon with the next installment of the Super League War. So thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.